Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. This episode features Daniel Freund, MEP, a member of the Executive Board of the Conference on the Future of Europe. Now, we had planned to have a full interview with Daniel this week, but he actually had to postpone because he's busy reacting to the corruption scandal that has just emerged in the European Parliament. Daniel is well known as a fighter against corruption. So for this episode, we have something different. Daniel speaking during a panel discussion that I also took part in. It was part of a workshop for the Jean Monnet Project Relay, chaired by Christine Neuhold. In this excerpt, Daniel gives some reflections on parliamentary democracy, the polycrisis, and the Conference on the Future of Europe. We hope you enjoy it. We will bring you the full interview with Daniel Freund in January.
How do parliaments contribute to making the EU more democratic? It's in big inverted commas. I'm an academic. I'm aware that this is not a very scientific term in times of crisis. And we will have a kickoff statement. And we will start with Daniel Freund, member of the European Parliament for the Greens, EFA, and member of the Executive Board of the Conference on the Future of Europe. So we're also going to look today at the Conference on the Future of Europe and how it has enhanced citizen involvement. Daniel Freund, I would like to give you the stage.
Thanks. Thanks so much for inviting me for this very interesting question, I would say. When you look at parliamentary democracy at the European level, I think, you know, whether you assess this as things are going well or things are going terrible always depends a bit on how far you zoom out. I think if you look at it from a historic point of view, you know, the European Parliament has been getting better and better, more democratic, more powerful, has contributed to the functioning of European democracy more and more. Yet when you're in it as a member of Parliament, it's at times also quite frustrating to see how far we still are from being a normally functioning Parliament, right? That we, you know, the most obvious thing is that we don't have the right of initiative. We don't have that one crucial power that every other parliament in the European Union actually has to suggest laws or to adopt the budget by ourselves. So I would say that particularly that fight with the council, you know, it's not on an equal footing. On many decisions, it's still the council alone taking decisions that at the national level would naturally be taken in the parliament. And I would say that in times of crisis, particularly when decisions have to be taken quickly, you know, it's not even in the questions there was talk, you know, usually then their decisions go more to the executive. I would say that in the European Union, decisions go more towards the council because we have that bizarre, you know, semi-executive, semi-legislature institution where the governments of the member states sit in the council. And we have seen that in the last few crises, you know, during the COVID response, when it came to the financial response to that, quickly there was the idea of, you know, this time around we're maybe not gonna make the recession even worse by saving lots of money into the recession, but that the European Union was going to invest, was going to try to do something against the economic meltdown. That worked, but that response, you know, although the Parliament discussed it and contributed to the discussion, the final decision, it was taken by the member states. We had no say, and particularly we now have very little say in how those 750 billion euros actually get spent, how that happens precisely. Again, no role or little role, I would say, for the European Parliament. And we see it now as well in the response to the energy crisis. The member states are pulling, I think it's Article 121, if I'm not mistaken, but special procedure that allows the member states, when the energy market is sort of under severe pressure, that they can basically decide in an emergency procedure without giving the European Parliament any say. So, you know, there is just a number of examples where we are circumvented. And while the European Parliament historically, as I said, has corrected some of this, we have gotten more and more powers where there's co-decision, but the most important questions remain ones of unanimity and decisions taken in the Council. And our attempt to do something about that was basically the Conference on the Future of Europe. Because our feeling was that, you know, through the normal procedures and in our almost inexistent dialogue, let's say, with the Council, we weren't really getting anywhere. There had been a number of reports in the European Parliament over the last few years where we suggested different potential treaty reforms and so on, but nothing happened, right? So then my idea, other members of the European Parliament's idea was, let's actually bring everyone into a room, because the European Union actually doesn't have a room where members of parliament, government representatives, the commission, national parliamentarians actually discuss. We only ever interact with the rotating presidency. You know, they show up in our committees and in plenary, they present the program of their presidency, but we never talk to the council. You know, even in our legislative conversations, well, we negotiate with every 6 months with someone else, but with the rotating presidency. So even to know, you know, does the presidency actually speak for themselves or the majority, or, you know, to figure out when they make a point is the diverging views in the room in the council is often quite some detective work. So we wanted to have a conference where everyone sits in the room. And where, well, I suggested very early on that we also have citizens and civil society in that conversation, because my view was that what had been done in Ireland with the citizens' assemblies, you know, randomly selected citizens that deliberated on two topics, actually, I think are the strongest example, on marriage for all and on the right to abortion, topics that had been hugely controversial in Ireland for decades, but that thanks to the citizens' assemblies ultimately led to referendums that, you know, more than two thirds of Irish people ultimately supported what the citizens had suggested, big success. So the idea was a bit, can we repeat that in Europe? Because, well, I and others felt that there's similar issues. You know, if you ask Europeans, do you think that a company like Apple should pay more than 0.005% taxes on the billions that they earn in Europe? You know, you get almost unanimity among European citizens that is probably a good thing to do. Yet it doesn't happen in reality, right? We're still not there. One of the reasons is the veto. And so we thought that a conference like that could maybe push that conversation. I'm going to stop here, and then you can ask me whether I think that worked successfully or not, or maybe the other speakers can talk about that, but I think there's some material to get us started.
I have a question still about, because you were there during the COVID pandemic, and now also with the energy crisis. Yeah, so how do these, you know, this polycrisis, this is a term that also former President Juncker from the Commission used. First of all, do you see, is this a term that's also used in the Parliament, the term of polycrisis? And how does this crisis actually, how does this impact on your work? So I would like to have a little bit more of reflection on these issues.
I haven't heard the word polycrisis a lot, but I mean, we're all aware that, you know, there is crisis after crisis, that, you know, the way I look at the union, I haven't been doing this since forever, but, you know, since the financial crisis, then migration, then Brexit, then COVID, now the war in Ukraine, we haven't really been out of crises for many days in those years. So obviously, yeah, it shapes us. And I mentioned the examples, you know, when we take decisions on the Corona Recovery Fund and now on the energy packages. Yet, since we have been continuously in crisis, it's also become a bit, you know, business as usual. You cannot be on red alert every single day. Then it becomes the normal alert level, so to speak, right? I think still, I mean, you talked about how the European Parliament has interpreted its role in a creative way that gives us additional space to discuss ideas, to maybe even get some things through. But I have to say that I also see, you know, the European Parliament is often, and I have to say I'm one of them, right? I ask for the European Parliament to have the right of initiative. I ask, you know, for us to have a stronger role in decision-making processes, more competences. But it's also true that the Parliament hasn't always been good at really fighting for those things, because we could have the right of initiative tomorrow if we really wanted to, if we were willing to kick out the Commission and say, we're not going to accept a Commission anymore that doesn't do what the Parliament wants, we would have the right of initiative. We could have a say on the recovery fund if we were willing to fight that through till the end when we were in those negotiations. We could also have imposed a working Spitzenkandidaten system in the European Union if we would have stuck to the line that was agreed by all the political groupings in the European Parliament ahead of the last elections, that we would only elect a Spitzenkandidat, or at least you might say someone that has run in the European elections, that would still have given you a choice of how many were we at the time, still 751 members of the European Parliament, right? But we do not always make use of that full power. Obviously, we're in constraints. Obviously, we also fear that, you know, if you overplay it, there might be popular backlash. You know, if you create institutional gridlock, at what point are Europeans going to say, do we still need that European Parliament thing that's just blocking everything? That's the gamble. But I'm also, you know, after the last European elections, for example, that we didn't even take a month more to figure out whether we could not find another solution than just voting von der Leyen into office, maybe refusing her once, whether then you do the refusal a dozen times is a different question. But, you know, those are quite kind of questions that I ponder when it comes to the role of the European Parliament.
And then I have a immediate follow-up question. So if the European Parliament could do this, why doesn't it do so? Is it because it's not a united, you know, because it's different political groupings, or how do you see that?
Well, I think particularly after the election, it played a role that two-thirds of the members of the European Parliament were new. And I also still think that lots of members of the European Parliament do not really, you know, think of themselves as strong independent members of Parliament. Also because the way that the lists are done and the elections work in some of the member states. I mean, look at France. Macron sits down in his office and draws up a list, and that's the list of La République En Marche. If you look at the Spanish Social Democrats, they feel that they're not necessarily, you know, their first task is not necessarily, I'm oversimplifying, right? But I have the impression that they feel that their first task is not necessarily to represent Spanish voters or Europeans in general, but to do the bidding of the Spanish Prime Minister in the European Parliament. I mean, the reason the negotiations among the four groups collapsed and that there wasn't a deal struck to vote Manfred Weber into office was that, well, both the Liberals and the Social Democrats changed their leadership. Both leaderships were under heavy influence from the French and the Spanish governments. And they sort of thought that they could get their own into the top chair. The Social Democrats wanted Timmermans, the Liberals, Margrethe Vestager. Well, and that all failed, and we got someone that didn't run in the election, and that was suggested by Macron. So he won that power struggle.
You've been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romanoff.